sitting through the slightly overrun oral argument we just had, we had a request for additional time for your argument, and each of you will be afforded additional time in the amount of 10 minutes. And I also would like to address, there was a motion filed to strike a supplemental reporter's record. Craig Price signed a motion. We don't have a motion to file a supplemental reporter's record, nor do we have a supplemental reporter's record. And I wonder if you might agree with the court that that motion to strike something we don't have is premature. I don't know about that either. I just know we don't. So I'm just really asking you, before we start oral argument, how we be careful that we're all talking about the same thing in terms of references we might make to the record in our oral argument. So let me ask, before we go further with this, would you please call the case? Counsel are all ready, I assume. So, Mr. Price, what about the motion?
I totally agree that it's premature. I do not think the supplemental reporter's record had been filed either, but in abundance of caution, they had filed their motion to prepare it, and so I filed my motion to strike, objecting to any efforts to supplement the record in the manner that they
So do you object to the court treating this as moot at this time as premature? Thank you very much. Then everyone understands we're talking about the record as filed when we make reference to the record in your oral arguments.
Thank you
very much. So, Ms. Weatherly, you're going to argue for the appellant. All right.
May it please the court. First, I want to say thanks for the additional time. Thanks for allowing us to come before you for oral argument. And I'm very pleased to represent Heat Shrink Innovations, Kevin and Deborah Wolf, and be accompanied by our trial team here, Mr. Bill Wood and Jesse Cromwell. With the additional time, I still don't have adequate time to fully discuss all of the issues in the case. In fact, I could use the 25 minutes to just talk about the facts of the case. So I'm gonna try to touch on the highlights of the highlights today. And in regards to the facts, there are some facts that I think distinguish this case from every other reported case that I have found. And that is, in this case, Mr. Wolf did not have any kind of non-disclosure agreement. Mr. Wolf did not have any kind of employment agreement whatsoever. There was no covenant not to compete ever presented to him. He never agreed that anything that he brought to the company would now belong to the company, METT, MET, you'll hear us call it. He never agreed that he was assigning his own intellectual property or his own designs to METT. They never said in writing or verbally, this design of this equipment is now ours. That they've never made a designation of Mr. Wolf as a key employee or a vice principal. And he was a W-2 employee. He was not an owner. He was not an officer, a director, a shareholder. He did have some, he was just a W-2 employee. He did have some managerial duties. But that's where it distinguishes this case from almost every other case I've read. In addition to the fact that many of the cases that we cite in the trial court record and the briefs are temporary injunction cases because, as I'm sure this court's aware, a lot of these trade secret, non-competition cases, fiduciary duty cases are resolved without a jury trial. So with that in mind, the only other fact I want to highlight is that HSI was formed September of 2010 and did not begin its operations until October 14th of 2011, over a year later. In that time, Mr. Wolf and Ms. Wolf had long resigned. They had been resigned 6 months before any of the actions taken to compete or any actual business was done by HSI. So what I want to talk about is what I think are the real questions at issue in the case that are, I hope to make more plain than they are set out in the brief. And I'll start off with saying this. When we did our reply brief, we realized that we had used an old description of the issues presented in our original brief. So on page one of the appellant's reply brief, where there is a list of the amended issues presented, that correlates to the issues that are within the body of the brief. The first and foremost question that we think that demonstrates that this judgment should be set aside and rendered is that the plaintiff simply didn't prove their lost profit damages. So it's a big, long trial, a whole lot of witnesses, a lot of exhibits, a lot of jury questions, but we come down to $600,000 on one damage line. So as you can imagine, that's where most of our efforts have been directed in this appeal.
Mr. Wolf, the only one that testified about the 50,000 figure?
I'm sorry, would you say that again, Your Honor?
Is Mr. Wolf the only one that testified about the 50% lost profit figure?
I do not recall if Mr. Bauer testified about that in trial. I know Mr. Bauer testified about that in his deposition because we cited that testimony in our motion in limine and in our objections to letting that evidence in. I cannot recall, Justice McCoy, as I stand here right now, if Mr. Bauer testified about that. But that figure is talking about METT's business. Generally speaking, they had a 50% profit margin. It's not talking about FEP heat shrink tubing. So we're involved in one product with one set of specifications, this heat shrink product. It's used in medical catheters. And Kevin Wolf knew how to make it. METT did not. They wanted to get into that business, and they hired Kevin Wolf away from TexLock to bring that technology to their company. Once they brought him in, he did assist in designing this expansion tube machine, and some years later, he went down the road and did it for somebody else, just like he'd done for METT. They never asked him to sign an agreement saying, well, now that you've come over here, this belongs to us. Another very confusing factor is that I think that the jury charge was lacking is that there was no distinction made between all these different machines. During the course of Kevin Wolf's employment, three different heat expansion machines were manufactured. And there's all kinds of testimony back and forth about how HSI's machine that Kevin Wolf helped build for them differs in many, many ways from the three machines that Met had. And we can tell from the question from the jury, they didn't know what we were talking about when we asked them about trade secrets. Which machine are you talking about? But that, of course, isn't where most of the damage was awarded. It was awarded for breach of fiduciary duty, and the lost profits calculation does not include any testimony that there was a 50% profit margin on FEP heat shrink. There was no information given to the jury that on these clients, these customers, here's how much money we made on these contracts.
Okay, I answered my own question because the ice storm got in my way of reading. Bauer testified that the percentage figure for profit for Creganna, and that's the main buyer of these products, right, was 50%.
Right, but Creganna bought all kinds of medical products from METT.
In addition to this one. Okay.
Yes, thank you. Thank you for an opportunity to clarify that, and thanks for finding the answer for me.
Where was the calculation disclosed to you? I know that there was a request for disclosure, and I think that's where the $150,000 figure comes in, and that was for the machine, correct?
Machine. The calculation of lost profits was disclosed to us on the stand in front of the jury for the first time.
And at one point, the trial court said, I'm going to limit it to what was disclosed in response to the request for disclosure. And then at another point, did she actually say, okay, you can get in whatever you want up to $5.5 million?
No, Your Honor. What happened was the testimony started coming in. We started objecting. The objections are in the record, and the objections were overruled. The trial court did not announce to us that she changed her mind or why she changed her mind. But that evidence did come in. The deposition testimony of Mr. Bauer does talk about a $5.5 million number he's seeking. But he admitted in his deposition he'd made no calculation. In front of the jury, that number was $1.2 million.
So that's where the $600,000 comes from for 50%. But where did he come up with $1.2 million in his testimony? How did he calculate that?
He said he looked at the prior 3 years of sales to Creganna and made a calculation of future lost sales. There was no testimony about any of the cost of making the product. There was no testimony about any future expectation of future business with Creganna, because what was undisputed was that Creganna had since moved on to another supplier, Zeus, for reasons completely unrelated to our case. And so there was no expectation that they were going to sell to Creganna in the future. They didn't have any kind of contract with Creganna or with any customer. They didn't put on any evidence of how much their actual net profit was on the product, how much they expected to sell of the product, nor did they ever put any evidence forward on their net after taxes, which I believe the Civil Practice and Remedies Code requires of us now. So we think that as a matter of law, they didn't get there on the lost profits. I think the best they got was some testimony about lost sales. But lost sales is not a compensable injury. They had to prove the net profit after expenses.
I want you to tell me that what you've said here in your brief is correct. Bauer testified that the percentage figure for profit from Creganna was 50%. However, Bauer did not testify as the basis for the 50% opinion because HSI's objection, the information not being disclosed, was sustained. So the expert was allowed to testify as to what his opinion was, but not the basis for it?
It wasn't an expert. It was Mr. Bauer.
Okay.
Right, the owner. That's correct. He did. She did.
Bauer hadn't been designated as an expert?
I'm sorry, I can't answer that, Justice McCoy. I should have anticipated that question. I'm sorry. I think the brief demonstrates that the lost profit damages were not proven as a matter of law, and I think that we have amply preserved our error on that. I think there's some other issues raised on this appeal that are important to clients other than mine. And that is simply, how is an employee supposed to know that it's his employer considers something to be a trade secret or considers some information to be confidential if they don't ever give them anything in writing, they don't ever have an agreement, there's no announcement, there's no notice of what exactly they consider to be a secret or confidential information. I think related factually here is whether this plaintiff, MET, had sufficient evidence to prove that any of its information was secret or confidential when the evidence was that the only efforts they took to protect their information was to have visitors come in. When the visitors came in, they signed in, and they had, you know, password protection on their computers like everybody does. I think that it is incumbent upon employers to make their confidential and trade secret status known to employees. Otherwise, how would employees who are just W-2 employees, again, not officers, not directors, not shareholders, how would they know that they have this duty, this common law duty, not to use that information, particularly when they brought it into the company themselves? How is a common law employee to know, an employee at will, to know about this common law duty not to use confidential information in competition with his former employer without some kind of announcement, some kind of warning by the employer? Another issue that I want to try to more plainly state is, how does an employee lose his ability to use his knowledge to make a living? An at-will employee who's never asked to sign an agreement comes to work for Met and lost, according to the trial court, lost his ability to use his knowledge of how to build an expansion machine when he left Met. How do other common law employees in the state of Texas understand that? How would they know if we have information on how to build a machine and we go to work for somebody else, we're going to lose the ability to use that information to make a living?
Well, don't you think his argument in response to that is going to be that when he brought in that other person, when the owner of Met was gone and showed him the machine, that there was something surreptitious in that? And I mean, don't you think that's going to be his response?
I do, and I acknowledge that there's some an emotional appeal to that that I think that appealed to the jury. On the other side of the coin, I'd say somebody who's trying to keep secret what their plan is doesn't form a business called Heat Shrink Innovations and have it, you know, up and going for, or create it 6 months before he leaves his employer. I mean, they didn't call it XYZ Company. The name of the company tells exactly what they're intending to do, make heat shrink products. What I agree that the way that the facts played out have some, that the jury could decide that it was surreptitious, as you mentioned, Justice. But I think that in our situation, just like other people in Texas, not just Kevin Wolf, an employee believes that they can use their information, their knowledge, wherever they go. And there's case law that backs that up. We've briefed that issue. But in this situation, Kevin Wolf came from TexLock with the information. Met hired him away from TexLock to get that technology. There's simply not any basis for believing that he knew he lost the right to use it. And what that goes to is HSI's joint and several liability for the damages for Kevin Wolf's breach of fiduciary duty. And, of course, that's an issue we also won't have a lot of different challenges to. But one is that the other owners of HSI knew nothing about any common law duty not to use information in competition with your employer. What Mr. Upchurch testified to was, ask him if he had a non-competition agreement, and he told me no, and I understood that he was fine. Kevin Wolf testified the same thing. I didn't have a non-competition agreement. I thought I could do whatever I wanted to do, as you know, after I left. So,
but. What about the customer list? What about soliciting a customer of his present employer to take to his new business that he's creating?
That does, while he was still an employee of Met, I believe that would be a violation of his duty. However, that wasn't the proximate cause of any damage, because Cregana Tactic never bought any product from HSI. It is the testimony unfolded, Cregana Tactic changed its vendor to Zeus, who was the premier supplier in the industry, long before this dispute ever came up. So even if he did breach his duty by talking to Kurgana Tactic employee about his plan, and Brent Turner eventually became the became a minority owner of the company, it wasn't the proximate cause of any loss of damages or any damages incurred. In the imposition of joint and several liability for HSI, they tried to do it in two different ways. One is they submitted a question on knowing participation based on common law cases, saying if you know that someone's got a fiduciary duty and you help them breach it, then you can be jointly and severally liable. And then they also submitted a conspiracy issue and found, and the jury found that Kevin Wolf conspired with HSI. And they've got problems with both of those. One is on the knowing participation, that common law case that they relied on to impose joint and several liability has since been abrogated by the legislature. Now, Met points out in their brief, and I agree, there's not a case that says that. That's what we're asking you guys to do. When the legislature says, we're amending the Texas Civil Practice and Remedies Code to say every tort claim gets submitted with proportionate responsibility, that's what they meant. And if they wanted to make an exception for knowing participation in a breach of fiduciary duty, they could have said that, but they didn't make any exception for it. This case should have been submitted with a proportionate liability question. These are torts. We did ask for it, and we did argue that. We also argued that in our motion for JNOV and our motion for new trial, that the rules have changed. All torts get submitted as proportionate liability. That's what the legislature says. So you don't get to go around imposing joint and several liability without a proportionate responsibility question. Likewise, on the conspiracy, there's several problems. One is the conspiracy question. Never ask if they were trying to accomplish an illegal action by legal means or a legal action by illegal means. There's a missing element. There's a Texas Supreme Court case that says that's a missing element. We moved for a directed verdict on that during the trial. We complained about that on JNOV. We complained about that in the motion for new trial. There's a missing element. Second of all, the Texas Supreme Court also says you have to have a finding of damages in order to impose joint and several liability on a conspiracy theory. They never submitted a question on damages. I didn't submit one for them. So to impose joint and several liability on HSI, factually, there's not any evidence that they knew about the duty. And legally, the question on conspiracy is wrong. There's a missing question on damages. And the whole scheme purports to do away with the proportionate responsibility scheme that the Texas legislature has announced applies to all torts. The evidence... damages, Justice has already mentioned that our complaint about Mr. Bauer's testimony being admitted when he did not disclose any of his expenses, his future potential sales, his tax burden, any of that kind of evidence. But what the ERI case says is you've got to have a clear damage calculation. It cannot be based on speculation. A loss of a major customer was not proven, and therefore there was not any evidence or insufficient evidence of proximate cause to support the $600,000 award.
Well, now, if I was the devil's advocate, I would say, well, the reason that he didn't reveal this information was because the trial court sustained your objection to the basis for his opinion.
The trial court sustained my objection to the basis for his opinion, but after she overruled my objection, allowing that testimony in.
So this is the part that we flip-flopped on later, we'll say. This ruling
This is the one that she reversed.
Yes, Your Honor.
All right.
And then I also want to mention, I have the utmost respect for my opposing counsel in this case. We've tried many cases against each other, as well as the trial court. The rules of the for preservation of error allow the trial court to fix their errors, and nobody, I think, would object to that. We did everything we could to bring these objections to the court's attention. We objected to literally almost every question in the charge. There was a very complicated post-trial procedural history. There were findings of fact and conclusions of law entered that for the missing elements. There was a motion for new trial granted, which was later vacated. There was motion for J&OV. And we've done what we could to bring these errors to the court's attention. Our rules are not designed to allow a party to benefit from that. And what I'm trying to say is that we're asking the court to reverse and render, because it would be manifestly unjust for our opponents to have the advantage of using this court's expertise in learning the mistakes that they made and not putting on their proof to adequately support a lost profit award, and then get a second bite of the apple with the motion for new trial or reverse and remand for a new trial. I am sure that Ms. Hammerly and Mr. Price, my opposing, very worthy opponents, will be able to, on the next trial, prove lost profits consistent with ERI. But we've had our trial. They missed their chance to put on sufficient evidence to support the $600,000. And in the jurisprudence of this state, mental anguish awards have often been taken away for insufficiency of evidence to prove a compensable injury. I think this is a very similar situation. There may be lost sales, but they did not prove lost profits, and that's what's required under ERI. The Supreme Court has spoken, and we ask that the court reverse and render. Thank you very much.
Thank you, counsel. Counsel, are you ready?
Court counsel. Justice McCoy, in response to your question about who testified about 50%, on page 22 of our brief, we also provide you with record citations in which Tom Bauer testified about a 50% profit margin at his business. Additionally, on page 22 of our brief, I go through a colloquy with Mr. Wolf about the 50% calculation for profit margins and how it's net profit. Again, that's page 22 of Appellee's brief. That testimony, Your Honor, was not objected to in any shape, form, or fashion. And it came from Kevin Wolf, in which he said, generally speaking, 50% profit margins on all of our business there at Met. Of course, the one client we were talking about, the only one we sought lost profits for in the past, was for Cregana. And so the jury was free to take the testimony from Tom Bauer, the testimony from Kevin Wolf about the 50% net profit margins, and apply that to its calculation.
Justice Gabriel. Cregana bought more than one product from Met, correct?
I believe they did, Your Honor.
But all you were damaged concerning was what they were going to compete with you on, and that was the heat shrink tubing, the catheter tubing, correct?
Not necessarily. I mean, I don't know that they were not going to do other lines of business as well. There
well
was
that
no
would
testimony.
Be speculation, would it not? I mean, there's no evidence to support that they were going to do other things, is there?
I don't think so, Your Honor. But there's no evidence that what we were talking about was all lines of product. In other words, I don't think Tom Bauer testified to numerous types of tubing product that went to Cregana Tactics from Met. So it may be possible that there were other lines of product, but I don't think so. And there was no testimony that there were other lines of product for a particular type of tubing that was not FEP heat shrink.
What about Zeus?
Now, that came about after Kevin Wolf had left, and at the time of trial, Mr. Bauer testified that at that point, Cregana was buying product from Zeus. Counsel told you that there's no proximate cause, that the actions of the defendants appellants here, proximately caused our damages, but in fact, we don't have to show that Heat Shrink sold the new product to Kagana. It's sufficient, I think, to show that Kagana stopped buying from Medical Extrusion Technologies because of the actions of Kevin Wolf. There's no reason why Kagana would not keep buying its product from MET, but for the involvement of Brent Anderson, the Kagana Tactics manager, who invested in Heat Shrink Innovations, got in business with the appellants, and conspired, if you will, to move that product from MET ultimately to Heat Shrink. It may never have occurred that it went to Heat Shrink, but it certainly went away from MET because of their actions. Mr. Anderson wrote a letter to a bank in order to get financing that I'm going to move all of my product from MET to Heat Shrink. He said, I'm going to move it to Heat Shrink.
He did not do it. Another competitor of the company that he invested in.
But they moved it away from MET, Your Honor. This never would have occurred had Kevin Wolf not used our figures, our sales figures, went out and got financing, got an SBA loan, got Mr. Anderson to invest in him, and move that product away from MET. Unlike some of the cases cited by the appellants.
Whoa. That's tortuous interference with contract. That's not this case.
Well, it can also be tortuous interference with the contract on behalf of some other defendants or some other parties. But on Kevin Wolf's part, it is a breach of fiduciary duty, Your Honor, because he was an employee the entire time he was setting up this scheme to divert business away from MET and toward Heat Shrink Innovations.
If he wasn't an officer, he didn't have a non-compete, he didn't have a non-disclosure, he didn't have any kind of employment contract, what established his fiduciary duty?
Your Honor, they cite you to the case of Johnson versus Brewer and Pritchard. It's a law firm case in which an associate at the law firm took a case that had been signed up with the law firm and went out on his own and tried to work the case up. That person was an employee, nothing more. The Supreme Court stated there that you have a fiduciary duty as an employee. Every employee has a fiduciary duty of some sort to its employer, not to remove information that is confidential to that employer or other business that would harm that employer if they find out about it during their employment. That's exactly what Kevin Wolf did in this case. He found out about information through his employment with MET.
What?
Such as sales figures, such as customer lists, such as products that these customers were interested in. He used that information, Your Honor, to obtain financing to start his company. He admitted to doing that. Those are the exhibits 15 and 16. He uses all these sales figures and says, I can give you 900,000 to 1.5 million sales a year and more. He got that directly from us. There's no way that he did that with Tom Bauer's blessing, with MET's blessing. He did it on the sly. Everything he did, Your Honor, was on the sly. He testified, I brought Alan Meyer and Mr. Terzini, the machinist, into the facility, MET's facility in Louisville, while Tom was gone. I didn't want him to be there when I showed them this expander machine I wanted them to create. He brought Brent Anderson down from Minnesota to Louisville to tour the facility before he invested when Tom Bauer was not going to be there. He knew Tom wasn't going to be there. He didn't want him to find out. He testified to that fact, all while he was an employee of that business, Your Honor.
Okay. So what's the duty is not to bring a visitor trespassing on the premises or?
No, the duty is to not use your employer's information regarding its customers, its sales figures, the types of products that your clients want, the contact information, to use that while you're an employee and to go out
divert business
and set up another company on the sly.
But then you still have to prove damages.
To divert business to a competitor of your new company?
Well, so while you're the manager of this company, you're asking your biggest company, your biggest customer, hey, would you like an alternative source of supply? Because I'm going to start a new company, and I'll send it to you. He didn't do that after he quit.
Well, no, apparently they said thanks, but no thanks, we're going to Zeus.
Well, initially they didn't. Initially, Brent Anderson said, that sounds good to me. I'm going to write you a letter saying I'm going to throw all of my business to your new company that I want to be part of. Now, the fact that it didn't work out for Mr. Anderson the way he wanted it to doesn't mean that MET was not damaged.
But did HSI or Mr. Wolf get any money that MET should have gotten?
As far as we know, we don't know, Your Honor. They've never been candid.
Well, then that's your burden to prove, though, isn't it? Isn't it your burden to prove?
We had to prove the damage to MET. they lost business that they otherwise, by all testimony, would have gone to Kregana Tactics, or the Kregana business would have gone to Met. It was going there for 3 years. Sales were steady for 3 years, close to $1.5 million a year for the previous 3 years. All of a sudden, it drops off.
Was there any testimony why they went to Zeus?
No, Your Honor. And there's no indication of when they actually started going to Zeus. Now, there was testimony that Heat Shrink Innovations didn't get started until, you know, operational until October of 2011. So after Mr. Wolf left, the sales from Met started going down. Mr. Bauer testified that after he left, the sales dropped from about $200,000 a month to $40,000 to $42,000 a month. You asked earlier, where did they get the figure for 1.2? That's where they got the figure. They calculated the difference of $200,000 minus $40,000, $160,000. They multiplied it times the months after Kevin Wolf left to the time of trial. It's basically $160,000 times 8. He left at the end of April of 2011, April 29th. So they calculated May through December. The case was tried in the middle of December. And it pretty much adds up to 8 months times $160,000, which is $1.2 million. And they applied the 50% profit margin, which again was admitted into evidence without objection through Kevin Wolf and also through Tom Bauer. And they came up with the figure of $600,000. That's one element of the damages for the breach of fiduciary duty.
Where did you disclose this calculation to them, Your Honor, prior to trial?
We disclosed information about lost profits during the deposition of Tom Bauer. He testified about the $5.5 million in lost sales, and they asked him questions about that. He also testified during his deposition, and it's in the brief, in the discussion with the judge outside the presence of the jury, Mr. Bauer testified about the 50% profit margins. So,
okay, but he never said 1.2 million or 160,000 times 8 and 50% net profit margin?
He never gave that exact calculation in that mathematical format, Your Honor. No, I don't think he ever said that. Certainly, the ERI versus Swinney case says, at a minimum, you have to give them objective facts, data, or documents from which lost profits can be calculated. And that certainly was what was done in this case. In the course of the trial, they had enough information, the jury did, to make its determination about lost profits. They say, or your question supposes that we have to provide a mathematical calculation. I don't think the courts require a mathematical calculation that shows the variables that have to go into that method. You have to provide sufficient notice to the defendant of what your damages are going to be. Throughout the deposition, that was done in the form of lost profits past and in the future. We gave them calculations of the total amount of lost sales. We told them what the profit margins were. And certainly they developed that testimony as well. There were many documents at the deposition of Mr. Bauer regarding lost profits, regarding the lost sales. So we believe that in the manner similar to the case attached to my appellee's brief, HHT versus Nationwide, we believe that we have provided the court or the jury with sufficient evidence to come up with a calculation of damages that they came up with. Briefly, that's where they gave the court, or where the jury gave us the figure of $600,000. They also provided damages for breach of fiduciary duty, Your Honors, of $94,000. That's the $150,000 figure that's talked about throughout the testimony in that discussion with the court. The expander machine that was created by Heat Shrink Innovations based upon our own expander machine cost Appley $150,000 to manufacture. They brought in Mr. Terzini and Mr. Meyer into the building. They took a look at it. They went back and they built their own. That cost them $56,000. If you subtract $56,000 from $150,000, that's where the jury got $94,000 as the other element of damages for breach of fiduciary duty.
What cost them $56,000?
It's an expander machine, Your Honor. It's about...
Okay, the building of it.
The whole creation.
Okay, okay.
That's correct.
Right, okay.
It cost the appellees $150,000 to make their expander machine. It cost the appellants $56,000 to make it. So the jury did the simple calculation, and that's what we asked them to do. And our closing argument in Volume 8 starts on about page 35. We set forth all of these calculations, including the 1.2, I think I used the phrase 1.112, and the jury came up with 1.2, times the number of months. I think I used the term 7 months, and they used the term 8 months to get their figure. We also asked the jury to calculate the $150,000 for the expander, subtract the $56,000 that they paid for theirs, to come up with the $94,000. That's exactly what the jury did in coming up with two elements of damages, $600,000 and $94,000. Those are the damages for breach of fiduciary duty. The damages for misappropriation of trade secrets is a little bit different. That figure was $15,000. What the jury found and what the evidence showed was that Kevin Wolf downloaded from his laptop provided by my client all of the information he needed as he was walking out the door. He took customer lists, he took schematics, he took other information about Met's customers, and he downloaded it onto a computer provided to him by Heatrink Innovation. This is all in the record, it's all in our brief. The jury calculated that figure, or that damage, at $15,000. They don't complain that there's no evidence, legally or factually insufficient, to support that award of damages. That is the amount, that is the figure of misappropriation of trade secrets, Your Honor. They also did not like the fact, as shown by the breach of fiduciary duty, that Mr. Wolf brought in Mr. Anderson, brought in Mr. Meyer, brought in Mr. Terzini into the facility and let them look at this expander machine. That's why they gave us damages for $94,000. That also, they felt, was a breach of his fiduciary duty. And he admitted that it was wrongful. He said, I didn't want Tom Bauer to know about it. I hid this fact from him. That evidence was clearly sufficient to support the jury's findings in those factors, Your Honor. With regard to the issue on proportionate responsibility, I respectfully disagree that the appellants requested an instruction on proportionate responsibility. The court's formal charge is in volume 8. It lasts from about page 1 to page 30. They make lots of objections. They never once object to the omission of an instruction or any kind of question regarding apportionment of liability between Kevin Wolf and Heatrink Innovations. In the additional findings of fact and conclusions of law that begin on page 376 of the court's, with the clerk's record, there's an additional conclusion of law that says they failed to ask for apportionment anywhere before trial was over. They have told you that there's no case requiring apportionment in a case involving civil conspiracy. It is a derivative tort. You don't need an additional question regarding damages because the damages are for breach of fiduciary duty. If you're liable or guilty of civil conspiracy, as the jury found in question 16, you don't need any additional questions regarding damages. There's no apportionment because Heatrink's liability for civil conspiracy is derivative of Kevin Wolf's liability for breach of fiduciary duty. I cited the court to a case, the federal district court case, Enron Securities, Enron Corporation Securities, but there's also another case that's not cited in my brief, North American Van Lines versus Emmons, in which the court also affirmed that same principle that you do not need apportionment under proportionate responsibility statute when you have a case involving a civil conspiracy. You know, Your Honor, it's from Beaumont, and I believe it's a no writ case.
What's the site?
Your Honor, I will have to can I provide it to the court in a
post-submission brief? I'd like to write them down so I can find them.
Fair enough. It is from Beaumont. It is from, I believe, 1999 or 2001, excuse me. Those are the only two cases that specifically affirm that you do not need apportionment. They didn't ask for it. No court has ever said you have to have it in a civil conspiracy case. With regard to the failure to submit a question on unlawful conduct, again, they didn't request it. Volume 8, page 1 through 30, the court's formal court's charge conference. They never objected to the omission of that question or that instruction. That would really be an instruction in which they would be required to object to it under Rule 279. They failed to do that. In the court's findings of fact, which I believe begin on page 357, 356, finding of fact 4 and finding of fact 5 both affirm that allegedly missing element of unlawful conduct. The court certainly deemed that finding, if necessary, under Rule 279. Therefore, we satisfied all the elements of our claim for breach of fiduciary duty.
Can the court do that?
Beg your pardon?
Can the court do that? Can the court just substitute a missing element for something that wasn't asking a question?
Rule 279, Your Honor, if there's evidence to support that, I believe the court can do that under Texas Rule of Civil Procedure 279. But the court certainly inserted that in its findings of fact and conclusions of law. There was evidence to support that finding, and they don't challenge those findings anywhere on their appeal.
Mr. Price.
Yes, Your Honor.
Two things that you cite as the conduct on the part of the defendants who didn't do right. You have reply issue number 3 in your brief, in which you are addressing the trade secrets. Counsel posed the question which started earlier, Ms. Weatherby. There's no confidentiality agreement. There's no covenant not to compete. There's no agreement that there would be a assignment of intellectual property. And how's an employee to know what conduct's acceptable or not acceptable? And you answered that in terms of what you provide in your reply issue to number 3 about the things that case law is determining to be trade secrets, and that are those are such things as customer lists, pricing information, client information, customer preferences, buyer contracts, market strategies, blueprints, drawings. And here you had a circumstance where the proof and evidence submitted, according to your brief, were things of all of the preparations that were being done, which covered a good many of those things that would be identified as trade secrets. Did I get your argument right there?
Yes, Your Honor.
In terms of your reply issue number 8, evidence that supports Kevin Wolf's violation of fiduciary duty, it's on page 31 of your brief. And there's no case cited in your argument, but you talk about the various things that were done by Kevin while he was an employee, and you list those with bullet points, thereby identifying an answer to the question posed by opposing counsel, what it is that an employee can't do. In other words, an employee owes the employer a duty of loyalty that includes not doing these things: soliciting investors and use confidential information to do that, using same confidential information to solicit a loan from the Small Business Administration, all those things that are in your bullet points. What authority, what case authority can we go to and look at and find that? You mentioned North American Van Line case out of Beaumont. Is there any other case?
Judge, there's a case cited by the appellants in their brief, and they cite it for position that supports them on lost profits. But it's very close to this case. It's kind of a manufacturing case, a manufacturing company, in which a key employee leaves and starts or goes to work for a competitor company. And the information that he takes with him and kind of it's not necessarily his own internal knowledge of the business, but it's information about the company he just leaves. And again, that's Glatley versus Airstarter. It is in their brief. It's cited in their brief. And he was found to have engaged in both breach of fiduciary duty and misappropriation of trade secrets, similar to our case. The problem with the lost profits there was their expert made assumptions that turned out not to be true.
Well,
I don't think that's the case
that
here.
Case, and I remember reading that in the opposing counsel's brief. My concern is just where to draw the line on where an employee with his interest in being able to make a living for himself and family is to be cut off from future business activity by virtue of what job they had with their past employer.
I think what Kevin Wolf did in this case, what offended the jury, in my humble opinion, Your Honor, is while he's an employee, while he's supposed to be using his best efforts on behalf of Met, is telling Met's biggest customer, I'm looking for a way to provide you with another source of heat shrink tubing or materials. Would you be interested in that? And again, while he's supposed to be selling materials to this client on behalf of Met, he's saying, how about a different entity? And Mr. Anderson, that employee for Krigana Tactics, the biggest customer of MET, says, not only am I interested in the new source, I'd like to be a part of that. And so he facilitates him becoming an investor by introducing him to Terry Upchurch, his longtime buddy, who knew all about that. And he brings Mr. Anderson to the facility and shows him around in a time when Tom Bauer is not there. Is that a misappropriation of trade secret? Probably not, just shepherding him through the facility, but it probably is a breach of his fiduciary duty, Your Honor.
So, taking information. So, Mr. Price, I'm looking for where we would be in terms of an opinion. If we were to write an opinion that sustained your position in terms of these things that are fiduciary duties for an employee, then we'd be essentially defining a series of events like you've got your bullet points, and then we would say in the totality of these circumstances, these amount to a breach of the employee's duty to do the best job they could do for their employer at the time, and not be preparing to leave at the same time and start a competing business.
Your Honor, I agree. I think it's similar to what Justice Potter Stewart said about another subject. I know it when I see it.
Understand.
And in this case, the totality of all the circumstances, all the conduct engaged by Kevin Wolf, in which he admitted to the jury, I don't want my employer to know about this. And I asked him, because you think he'll get fired? I don't know.
But the damages for the breach of fiduciary duty was the $94,000 for the machine.
Right.
And the argument was by Ms. Weatherly that that machine was created because of Mr. Wolf's expertise. Therefore, all these other things that he did, how does that factor into those damages? If that's his knowledge, you're saying he has to leave his knowledge behind at that employer and not use it in the next one?
I'm not saying that, Your Honor. The jury also heard testimony from Scott Steele. This is, that's my machine. When Mr. Steele on the stand saw pictures for the first time of the expander machine created using photographs and schematics and so forth from the machine that Scott Steele himself built, he said, that's my machine. And the jury heard that, and they were free to reject any testimony from Kevin Wolf and accept the testimony of Scott Steele. And remember, they don't have a complete record. I would submit to this court that you really can't consider any issues of factual or legal insufficiency of the evidence because they failed to present the deposition testimony of Brent Anderson.
If we don't need Brent Anderson's testimony, then why does that preclude us from considering their issues on the merits?
I didn't say you didn't need it, Your Honor. I don't believe I said you don't need it. I think you do need it.
But they don't rely on it in their brief. Do you agree with that?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. You do agree with that.
I do agree. Okay. They don't rely upon it.
They don't rely upon it in their brief. So if we don't need it, then why does that the fact that it's not there, why does that preclude us from considering their issues on their merits?
I don't agree that you don't need it. I think in order for them to assert any claim for legal or factual insufficiency of the evidence, they have to present you with a record that includes all of the evidence. They did not do that.
Do you have any authority for that?
I cited the authority in my brief, Your Honor, under reply issue number one.
Okay, but your argument was that they had to set forth their points on appeal because this was some sort of restricted appeal, correct?
That's not really my point. I was saying that they didn't file this as a restricted appeal. That's the only way that you can legitimately submit a case to the court without all of the evidence if you're going to assert legal or factual insufficiency of the evidence. Because they did not submit this case as a restricted or limited appeal, they are precluded from prevailing or presenting to this court a claim of legal or factual insufficiency for any issue.
Assuming that this person testified on the issues about which they are complaining. What if he testified on attorney's fees? What does that have to do with the issues of insufficiency of evidence on other issues?
It would not, Your Honor. Okay. But I would submit to the court that Brent Anderson's testimony affects every issue of importance regarding liability and damages because he testifies, or he did testify, regarding Krigana Tactics, regarding his investment in Heat Shrink Innovations, regarding his trips to Texas to view the facility when Tom Bauer was away. His testimony was not insignificant for a lot of these issues. I submit to the court that the only issues that it probably doesn't affect are reply issues 2 regarding standing, reply issue 6 regarding a double recovery.
All right, before you get away, jury trial, findings of facts?
Well, we also sought a permanent injunction, Your Honor, and we requested the court to award a permanent injunction, which the court did.
Yes, I saw that.
So we asked for those findings of fact and conclusions of law in light of the argument regarding missing elements.
Got it.
Thank you.
Please add 6 minutes to the time allotted for rebuttal. Counsel, if you're ready.
Thank you. I want to take a minute, if you're ready. Thank you. I want to take a minute to talk about the supplemental record, just briefly. During the course of the trial, the videotaped deposition excerpts from Brent Anderson were played to the jury. Both sides said the court reporter doesn't need to take that down. In the appellee's brief, they mentioned for the first time, oh, wait, we can't have an appeal because Brent Anderson's testimony wasn't transcribed. They cite an old rule that no longer is in effect and talk about a limited appeal, and it applies when you ask for less than the whole record. We asked the clerk to prepare the entire record. We set it all out. That's in the clerk's record, and it's cited in our response to the motion to strike. Also in the response to the motion to strike, I point out that appellee has made misleading statements to the court about waiver of that transcription. I point you to page and line in the reporter's record where Mr. Price or the Mets attorneys have said, well, counsel waived their right to have that testimony transcribed. It can't be considered. Now all your issues go away. And what I actually said was, we'll provide that later. We waive the right for the trial court reporter to try to keep up with the video, and told her we would submit it to her in writing later. We have now. We did not realize it was missing, but we have now, and that's why we've sought a supplemental court reporter's record. We've given her the agreed upon excerpts that both sides, or it was actually the appellee's Mets witness, and it's their excerpts, which they designated ahead of time. We've given that transcript to the court reporter, and my understanding is she has not yet supplemented the record. Both sides are presenting argument about that supplemental record. I think that the court should consider the supplemental record because I think it is manifestly unfair for an appellee to take the position, well, all of your issues on appeal are waived because you didn't have a full record, but don't supplement to make that record full. I mean, that's just a technical gotcha. And we think that that's not appropriate. We would ask the court to consider the supplemental record. What the supplemental record shows is that testimony that we were talking about earlier, where the decision to go for Kagana Tactic to go to Zeus was made by somebody in Ireland who knew nothing about this dispute and had nothing to do with HSI or Kevin Wolf. But speaking of Kevin Wolf, what we heard from Appley's oral argument just now is that Mets profits took a nosedive when Kevin Wolf left. Before HSI did anything, before HSI started business, well, slavery's been abolished. They can't make Kevin Wolf work for him. If Met lost profits because Kevin Wolf left, that's not a compensable injury. He didn't have a contract to work for them for life.
What is the timing of the loss of the Zeus business, his leaving, and the coming on board of HSI?
I don't know the exact date of the timing of the Zeus business.
And where?
I don't know what the record will demonstrate on that, Your Honor, but I will say that Mr. Wolf resigned in April, and HSI did not begin operations until October. Now, where the Zeus I mean, the Met business went to Zeus at the time. I don't even know if that was proven. I just can't speak to that. Justice McCoy, and I apologize. I don't know that that's in the record.
I have two questions based upon his argument. One is, I thought you had said that you asked for a proportionate liability question and you were denied. He said you didn't.
I was going to bring that up. Thank you, Justice Gabriel. Kind of like the oral argument we heard earlier this afternoon, there was, and the record reflects, there was over 6 hours of informal charge conference in this case. And the discussion about proportionate liability is not in the record. He is correct. We did bring that up in our JNOV motion and our motion for new trial.
And what about the missing element on the conspiracy question? Because Rule 279 would allow her to make that finding or conclusion of law, finding of fact, on a missing element if the evidence supports it, if you didn't object to it.
We move for directed verdict on conspiracy.
Okay, but is that the same as objecting to the question, the form of the question?
Again, I know that that was made by Mr. Wood in the informal conference. I don't think it's in the record.
Thank you.
Thank you. The rules are supposed to be liberally construed to provide a complete record to this court for review, and Mr. Price is contending today that that testimony is important. Even though we don't rely upon it in our brief, we think that because of his argument today, it should be considered by the court. Now, back to Justice McCoy's comments to me about the calculation based on the argument by Met. Mr. Price told you today that the 50% profit margin was testified to by Tom Bauer at his business, and that Mr. Wolf testified about the 50% profit margin on all our business. That is the point we're trying to make. It's not specific to this product. It's not specific to these customers. And ERI says you've got to make a calculation. The rules of disclosure say you've got to make a calculation. The jury has to be provided the information, the facts and the figures for the calculation.
Well, let's just, well, go ahead. I'll find it in a minute, then we'll see where we're taking issue here.
We heard when Appley's made their oral argument about the $94,000. Today is the first day I've heard a calculation of that damage. There has not been any any disclosure in the deposition or in the written disclosures about this $94,000 damage award.
Wasn't there about the $150,000?
Well, there was testimony that it cost $150,000 on direct examination by Mr. Bauer. But on cross-examination of Mr. Bauer, he also admitted that it was all created by people who worked for him, including Kevin Wolf, who were going to draw a salary whether they built a machine or not, that he wasn't actually out of pocket.
So let me see if I am understanding. He was not a testifying expert, so on disclosure we won't look at the rather general amorphous requirements of disclosure there, but you want to go to 194.2D, which requires the disclosure of the amount and any method of calculating economic damages.
Correct. Okay. That was our objection at the trial court. The trial court agreed with us on motion in limine. And as we discussed, kept it out, let it in, and then it ultimately let in the number but kept out the calculation. I would need to talk about the permanent injunction, and I apologize, I didn't talk about that earlier, but when Mr. Price starts discussing this breach, this horrible breach of duty of taking away the customer lists and calling on these customers, in addition to the fact that it wasn't the proximate cause of the damages, as we discussed earlier, just because something can be a trade secret, as Justice Meyer pointed out from the bullet points, doesn't mean it is a trade secret. It has to be kept secret. And my argument is the only way the employee knows his duty is if you tell him, this is secret. There's no evidence that anything Kevin Wolf did, he was told this is secret. As Justice Gabriel points out, there's circumstantial evidence that he might have known what he was doing was wrong. But there's no evidence that we said this is our secret. And you have to do that to maintain something as a trade secret. But on the permanent injunction, I beg the court to look at the court's judgment and the list attached to that judgment, and you will understand, I think, why we have this attack on the permanent injunction as not only being a First Amendment violation on free speech, but more importantly, it is so unenforceably vague as to be unconstitutional.
Where did that list come from?
That list was an exhibit by the plaintiff. There was not testimony about what those people, entities, or things are, and there's no evidence that Mr. Wolf called on any of those people or that any of the that all of those people were METT's customers. There's one entry on that list that's farm, literally, F-A-R-M. No explanation, no city, no state. Is it a business? Is it a company? Is it a farm? Is it somebody's name? That permanent injunction cannot stand the way it is written. It is impermissibly vague. And very, very briefly, the citation to the case that says that the finding of liability on an underlying tort on a conspiracy case has to be supported with a damage question is contra THPD versus Continental Imports. It's an Austin Court of Appeals case. It's on page 82 of our brief. The plaintiff in the case was required to get a damage question on the conspiracy cause of action, did not, and it was not the defendant's burden to submit that question. I'm out of time. Thank you so much for your attention.
Well, Ms. Weatherly and Mr. Price, thank you for your argument. Your case is submitted, and you're excused for the day.